Now I have the privilege of introducing the warm-up speaker, who is Stacy. If you want to come up, Stacy. And give her a warm welcome.
My name is Stacy. I'm an alcoholic. I just want to thank Bruce for asking me to come and be the warm-up speaker, because I never thought that would happen. I think I'm humbled to a fault, so I'm just going to talk about how it was, what happened, and how it is now. How it was when I came in, I was very broken. This was not even an option, me talking in front of everybody or even hanging out with people was very scary for me. Always wanted to avoid it at all costs. I felt lost in a lot of ways. But when I started drinking, and for me, other substances, I always wanted to not be present. And that's how I think I knew at an early age that I was an alcoholic, because I didn't enjoy drinking. I just did it to escape and not be here. And I also had a lot of self-harm tendencies. And later on, as time went on, it progressed quickly. And a lot of people ended up seeing my behavior, a lot of my negative behaviors, and didn't want to even look at my positive ones. I don't think I really had that many at that time, so I don't think it was hard. But so what happened for me to get how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, like the second time around, the first time I actually just came in to the rooms, not by accident, but I kind of wanted to see what it was about. And I think the longest time before now is I believe a year of honest time, maybe a little less than that. And so what happened for me to get me here today was, my self-harm behavior ended up being very extreme. And I just didn't know how to deal with life. And I had very unhealthy relationships, circumstances. And when I was in that black hole, I couldn't get out. And it took hospitals and, psychiatric facilities or psych wards to kind of get me here. So when I came in the second time around, I was very broken. And a lot of people in this room took me in when I didn't love myself and I didn't think it would work. But gradually it has been. I don't do the program perfectly. I do have a willingness and I do have a spiritual foundation. And that's what got me closer to my higher power. And today I have one. When I started coming into the meetings, I started talking to people. And like my sponsor tells me, how she told me before, you go to meetings and you spread the message, you talk. That way you're able to help another person. And I'm talking today because, not for myself, but because I want to help somebody else that felt as lost as I did. And for the introverts and for the ones that it's definitely hard to get out, I'm speaking to them as well. And today, I don't know, I'm probably going to keep it shorter than 10 minutes, but I'll try to extend it. but today, my willingness is still there. I do have a small circle of people that I do share my feelings with, a great sponsor. I do work in recovery. That's something that I didn't think I would ever do again because of how my life kind of just went down. And with that came a lot of fears of coming back and going into different avenues, I guess. And today I'm able to pray. I'm able to go through situations that I've always been so afraid of doing. Like if somebody asked me to speak or in front of a huge crowd of people, I would have ran away. And I'm not always impeccable to my word, but I'm so much better than I used to be. And I'm clean and sober today doing it. And today I'll also, talk to people that are were just as broken as I was, and I give them words and inspiration. And that's something that I never thought that I would do either. And I'm just so, grateful to be here. This is, I would say, my extended family. And I love each and every one of you. And I really appreciate this time that you guys allowed me to have. Thank you.
She's precious, isn't it? I just love hearing Stacy all the time. Thank you, Stacy. Before I introduce our next speaker, I'm here with my sponsor today, and she reminded me just a moment ago that I might be owing Bruce an amends. That's you, Bruce. Because we took the speaker from your table, it was my idea, and we took him to our table not knowing he belonged to you, and I don't think he's going back. I did have the privilege of meeting Don and Ricky, who are here from Mill Valley, yeah. And I'm so grateful that I got to sit with him and his friend. And what a interesting guy you are. He's a naturalist photographer, and he has these amazing pictures of these amazing animals, owls and coyotes, and it was a good time. So I'm glad I got to know you. I'm not inviting someone up I haven't met. So would you please come on up and come on up and. I sort of messed up. You're walking Don. You're not Don. You're walking Don.
Yes.
Why is that?
Because I walk.
Okay.
Is that good?
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Don, alcoholic, I'm honored. And thank you, Bruce. I really appreciate. Oh, what are you going to do?
I'm going to try to adjust this thing here.
Okay. Yeah, I talk loud anyway, so. I love the day I walked into AA. I love it, and I put it out there, It'll take a newcomer 28 years to get what I got, but it'll take me 1 minute to become a newcomer. And sometimes I think about that, man, and it terrifies me, because if I went out, and even if I made it back into these rooms, I would never have what I have today. So I'm just staying in here and love AA. And, of course, I've always, the day I walked in here, I start doing commitments, and I still do them over 28 years later, and they've been very important, because no matter what happens, my commitments are the most important thing in this world. A couple years ago, show you how this thing worked, and I actually there was a time that I had a wife and three kids. And of course, you know, I got back into my behavior, you know, back in prison and that. But I was in one of these meetings, a noon meeting in Mill Valley, and I got a telephone call from my ex-wife, and she told me my daughter just passed. And what happened, she went in for some kind of procedure, and she didn't wake up. And my daughter was 40 years old. But I had to go speak at a meeting at the senior center, and I knew that right away. I went there. And then I had to go set up a meeting, which I've been setting up for years and years and years. And I learned in these rooms is how to talk about this stuff and share the pain with other human beings. So you don't have to take the full thing. And I'm not exempt, because life happens, you know, it happens whether I like it or not, man. And it's my deal is just don't drink no matter what. And use these rooms. These rooms are so incredible. I was kind of laughing at our little warm-up speaker there, because I came in through NA, and I remember, and I used to go to 7 meetings a day, because, you know, I didn't know what are you supposed to do, man. So I just went to meetings. And I remember there's a young speaker, and he said, young secretary, and he said, sir, would you like to speak? And it was a speak and tweak meeting, a freak and tweak meeting at 12 o'clock. I told him, yeah, I'll speak, you know, and it was candlelight, and the room was packed, you know. And you know, when I was standing there, I say, what's the worst thing that could happen to me? And then they could have said, well, he's lying or he's an idiot. But I knew all those things, so that was not a big deal. And I used to also run from the police, and the police would always be shooting at me because that's the only way they'd catch me. And I said, well, that's not that big of a deal, man. You know, my life in the past, that was a big deal. So I got up, and I just started talking. You know, it was candlelight, and everybody was just quiet. Nobody moved. And I kept talking, and this is the first time in my 49 years that I've ever talked. And I just kept talking and talking, and then all of a sudden, I hear a little pull on my leg, and he said, sir, can you cut it? There's another meeting coming. I talked for 6 hours. That was the first time I ever talked. And I've been talking ever since. And love it, you know. And, you know, I didn't get in here because I thought I was an alcoholic or because I was a drug addict. You know, the system, the Department of Corrections, you know, finally they got me and they sat me down and they said, look, most people that come to San Quentin get it, but we can't get rid of you, you know. You know, I'm a 7-time loser, you know, and they're writing up that strike 3 thing. And they said, you either straighten up or you go into prison for the rest of your natural life. And I remember that was the first time I ever felt that cold, cold feeling, you know. And because they were building Pelican Bay and these youngsters were coming in with 350 years. I wonder, how the hell did you do it 350 years? Well, they finally got me. My biggest fear is confinement, although you'd never know it. So I could, you know, I felt like San Quentin was like, hey, keep coming back. Well, they got sick and tired of me coming back, so they got me. So I came into rooms and been here ever since and love it. Although, I didn't know what to do. So I just went to meetings, you know, and went to more meetings, you know. But I would sit on one side of the room, and everybody would sit on the other side of the room. And that's how it was, man, because I was not approachable. You know, don't even step inside of my circle. I spent my whole life to keep people away. And my whole thing when I was in San Quentin was, you know, I'm going to wake up alive, stay alive today, and I'm getting over that wall some way. Although I never got out of San Quentin. But I got out of many other jails, boy. The prison system don't care if you kill somebody, but when you escape, for some reason, they all take it personal. So anyway, I started my thing in 1949. I was put in a juvenile hall in San Francisco. I'm from San Francisco. And I remember my mother put me in there, brought me down there. And I was 9 years old. And they made up a brand new charge because I was uncontrollable. They couldn't keep me anywhere. I just liked to wander away. Man, I would drive these mothers crazy if they had a little boy like me. Because 5 years old, I used to just wander all over San Francisco. I just love it. And so anyway, she packed me up one day. I didn't know what she was going to do and took me down to juvenile. And, you know, I've been in all the juveniles in San Francisco. If you've ever been to San Francisco, 150 Yoda Street, that tall one, that used to be the first juvenile. Then I ended up in Washington and Kearney Jail. And then, of course, I had 375 Woodside. So anyway, and I wasn't really a criminal. I was just a nuisance, you know. And, like, funny thing happens with me. If you put alcohol in me, funniest thing happens, I start finding stuff. You know, it's San Francisco's a great place to find things. I find cars all over the place. Police call it car theft. I found it. So anyway, so that's my life. And I remember, though, when they brought me into the juvenile, man, I was kicking and screaming, man, because I hated that confinement. And then the man told me to shut up. So I shut up, man. And then I was watching these kids. There'd be one little kid, one special little kid, he'd mop the floor after each meal. And then he'd just go outside and hang the mop on a little mop rack and come back in. And I'd say, stupid little kid. So I waited for a brand new man to come on. And I grabbed that mop. And I just start mopping. And I just start mopping. And I remember I got to the door. And like when you're 9 years old, you don't look like a little crook, a criminal. And I got to the door. My little thing was going, you know, my little head was spinning. And I said, I wonder if he knows what I'm going to do. And then that man came. They all had this long keychain. And he came. And I remember I felt the key slide in and it clicked and he pushed it. Oh, I just felt that cold air all over me and I loved it. So he pushed the door all the way open. But I didn't hang no mop, man. I just flew out that door. And there was a wall, so I had to make a left and I hit that fence at two leaps. I was over, gouged with the barbed wire, man. And there he is. I could hear him behind me. Come back here, you little son of a bitch. And there was freedom. And I wanted to be free, man. So I hopped over the fence and went up there. And I got an escape record about 15 times. In fact, I broke Michael Hennessy's perfect record. I escaped out of his jail. So anyway, you know, but what happened is when I came into this room, I had to start learning. If I would have climbed back right then, I would have learned these things they call coping skill instead of drinking, drugging, and running. So I had to start learning that, and it started right into these rooms. So, you know, I came in these rooms, and I'd sit down in a meeting, and I'd go to meetings. And then I walked in to a Thursday night speaker meeting, and then the secretary hollered my name. He said, hey, Mose. I said, man, who's that dude, a cop or something? He ended up, he was my cell partner in 1960 in San Quentin. And he got out, and he ended up coming into the rooms, and he had 22 years sobriety. And I said, oh, man, because I'd hear, get a sponsor. I said, oh, man, that dude's going to be my sponsor. See, you don't get what you get exactly what you're supposed to get, you know. And so he brought his buddy in with the exact same amount of time. And his buddy had 20 years, or 22 years. And his buddy used to be a cop. I said, oh, man. So ended up with my sponsor. And so we go to coffee down 20th and Mission there. In my last 10 years in the pen, I was this jailhouse philosopher. So I just started dumping and dumping and dumping. And then he stopped me. And he said, "You're a criminal." I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Yeah, you're a criminal." I said, "But I'm not. I'm getting pissed off because I think it's just a fellowship and we stick together no matter what." But it don't work that way. And finally, he said, "How could you not be a criminal? You've been in and out of the system for 42 years. And finally, something broke and cracked. And I said, "Wow, I'm a criminal." And that was the first time I've ever admitted to anything in my 49 years. And then he said, "Now you've got to be part of society." I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Yeah, you've got to be part of society." I said, "No, I'm not." And something cracked again. And I said, "Wow, I got to be part of society." But what the hell you do being part of society? So he made a list. And the first thing was work. I said, "I'm not going to work." He said, "Yeah, you got to work." I said, "No, I don't. You got to work. You're a civil servant. You work. I'm not going to work." But God, you know, God doesn't think like I do. And funny thing is too, when I came into rooms, I not only went to the meeting, but, you know, this is a rare occasion. You'll very rarely see me with any long pants on and all this stuff, because I just run around in shorts. And so I cut the shorts, threw my shirt away, and I start walking. And I used to walk every day in San Francisco. And then the program would kick in, and it said, "Follow suggestions, go to any lanes." And I see a little sniping eye sponsor telling me to get a job. And it was kind of wrecking my day. So I start walking into these places, and I tell, "Give me a job." He said, "You can't get a job like that." I told him, "I don't want a damn job. I'm just doing it because my sponsor told me." And I got the job because I was doing the footwork. AA is all about the footwork, not what I think, not what I say. It's about what am I doing. You know, and that's how my journey began, you know. And I had to learn. I've done so much stuff in these rooms. And I acted out on so much stuff, you know. And finally, you know, I start reacting to things, man, you know. And they would get worried about me. Of course, you know, I'm around with Frank Brennan and Cy Payne and the whole crew, you know, and they just kind of huddled around me and start teaching. I remember I'd be walking in the city, and Frank Brennan used to say, "Look, when people start talking, just keep walking. Don't even turn around." You know, so I remember I was walking through Union Square there, you know, they have these walkways, and I'm walking, and all of a sudden, and I'm just in my shorts and no shirt, all of a sudden, I hear, "Hey, you faggot." Man, and Frank Brennan said, "Just keep walking." And it, you know, I just had to turn around, and there was nobody else there. And then he pointed, you faggot, talking to me. And that was it, man. It just set me off, man. And I just downed him. And blood was popping all over. And the little voice said, "Stop, you're going to kill him." So what happened is I stopped and I started walking away. And this couple seen him. And then I heard them say, "Well, is he a faggot?" And then he gurgled, "I don't think so." So I talked to my sponsor about it, and then he had to send me into, I've been into many programs, and I had to deal with Recovery Incorporated to deal with that, because if I didn't, it was going to take me back, you know, I mean, because I reacted. And so anyway, I'd walk every day. I'd walk, man. I remember I started walking down to the ferry building and back, and that was the most hugest thing. But I just kept doing it. And then I'd walk down to Fisherman's Wharf and that. And I'd walk to all the meetings. I used to walk to all the meetings because I didn't have no car, no phone. And thank goodness my sister lived up on Potrero Hill. And she had the house. And her brother-in-law was an alcoholic. But my sister wanted me there because I was clean and sober, you know. And she knew as long as I was there, he was going to do this. Because we are kind of co-each other. And So I got to do that. I got to go to meetings, you know. And the job, I hated it. And so I was looking at the bus bar, and I could have thrown, it was a welding shop, and I could have thrown a big piece of steel up into the thing. And the little voice said, "You can't commit no felony. You can't break the law like me. No lawbreaker." So I did the next best thing, and I got miserable. And if I'm going to get miserable, everybody's going to be miserable. So I made all the workers miserable, the foreman miserable. And then I went up to the office, made old gals in the office miserable. And then people that walked by, made them all miserable. And then they finally came up and said, "What do you want?" I said, "What could you give me?" They said, "How about unemployment?" I said, "Yeah." And I love that, you know. So, you know, and I got unemployment. So I went to Tuesday Downtown. Tuesday Downtown used to be a weekly meeting as big as this. And I used to just get out there and I'd greet everybody. No, you couldn't get in that meeting without me greeting. And I start reaching out. But there was another problem, though. You still couldn't get close to me, man. I had this circle around me, man. I don't even step into it. And so this gal came up to me and she said, "Oh, why don't you go to an AA dance?" I said, "Man, you wouldn't catch me dead at no dance." God thought that was funny. So he sent me a flyer, one from Chicago and one from San Francisco, and it came by the same day. And it said, "Report to this dance retreat." I said, "Oh, man, you know." So if one woman tells you something in AA, man, it's hard, but if two women, just go do it. So anyway, I went up there. And it was a dance retreat, and it was 10 women and me. I'm saying, wow, man. So these two gals got up on the stage, and I never seen an interaction with two human beings, you know, because like me, I was, you know, don't even get close to me, man. And they started interacting, and then they told me, "Get up on the stage." I told them, "I ain't going to do that. I don't even know what it is." She said, "So shut up, get up there." I said, "Oh, man." So I'm up here, and there's 10 people looking at me. And they're telling me, I said, "I don't even know what it is." He said, "Well, just think of something and move." So the only thing I could think of was like a deer. And like my deer was like frozen for 40 years. But it was terrifying. But after that, they got me into these classes. It was improvisational dance. And I'd keep showing up. And each time I'd get and perform in front of people, something would just rip a little farther. And I'd want to just push it a little farther, a little farther. And I kept doing that, kept doing that. I ended up dancing at Fort Mason in San Francisco, you know. And now I could just walk up. I think I go into jails and I just walk right up to these dudes and they'll be freaking out, you know. Not me, man. Because I learned, man, through AA, man. And that's very important. So, you know, 1995, they're having a world convention in San Diego. So, you know, I picked up the map and I said, "Wow, man, I'm tired of walking in circles. Man, I want to walk straight." So that's what I start doing, man. You know, I start walking to San Diego, the convention. But there was something wrong with that walk because, you know, if you look a long ways, you'll see a haze. Well, that's what I do. I walk to the haze, and then there'd be another haze. And then I walk to that haze, and the whole thing was walking to these hazes. And it wasn't like how I walk normally. So I didn't like that. So when I got back, I got on a bus and went to Brookings, Oregon. And I started walking back from Brookings, Oregon. And I was going through Crescent City, the Prairie Creek area, and then I was going through the Avenue of the Giants. And I was just totally present. And I loved that, you know, just being totally present. And then when I got finished with that, I never been on a plane. So I got on a plane, no planes no more. One time's good enough. And I went up to the Canadian border, and I was going to go across the Canadian, go up to Victoria, cross over the island, walk down. And, of course, the Canadian asked, what am I going to do? They said, got money? I've got money. They said, what are you going to do? I told them, I'm going to walk. And then they asked that question, have you ever been arrested? I said, well, do you really have time to listen? And then they asked, well, when were you arrested? I said, well, how far back you want me to go? So they wouldn't let me into Canada, escorted me back to U.S. U.S. said, what's the problem? I said, I don't know, talk to the Canadians. And he said, well, wait. So two Canadians were getting ready to come to the United States, so he kicked the two Canadians back. So I'm worth two Canadians, and I've done my walk from the Canadian border down to San Francisco, which was 1,000 miles, 1998. I got on a train and started a walk from Boston to San Francisco, which was 4,600 miles. So you could do whatever you want, man. But another thing is, like with me, I never knew how to take care of my health, and I start learning how to take care of my health, you know, and I found out I take one little bad thing out, put one little good thing in. I've done that physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and it's amazing. It works. So in 2000, oh, then my unemployment was running out. And Clinton was the president, so he was giving everybody extensions, and I just knew I was going to get an extension because I'm in recovery and I'm not breaking the law, so I'm special. Doesn't work that way. God was saying, look, you little asshole, you've been living off taxpayers inside prison all your life. It's about time you go to work. So I didn't get the extension. My little heart was just, see. But God put somebody in my life that lived in Marin, and she used to, you know, work with these elderly people, and they did yard work. So I started doing yard work, and I love working with the elderly because they used to let me work my shorts, and they tell me, work at your own pace. You know, I just pull weeds and clean up. And I got a little truck, and I had some weeds in there, and then some woman came up to me and asked me, you know how to trim trees? And you ask me anything, and I know how to do anything. And she said, well, why don't you go down and give me a bid on these trees? So I thought it was a tree, and I went down there. It was blocks and blocks and blocks of trees. I said, oh, man, I'll be in a tree the rest of my life. So I got the job, man. But 2 weeks before I started that job, another dude came up and asked me, and I said, yeah, I know how to trim trees. So I was up trimming his trees. And some dude was walking by on the sidewalk. He said, wow, I never seen trees look like that, but they look good. So I'm tripping. I got down. I said, no wonder, dude, you ever never walked a big yard like I did. The only thing I ever seen high was gun towers. So my trees were all looking like gun towers. So I had to start learning what trees look like, you know, and I've done trees, big trees. I've done them for over 25. And I've done a lot of stupid stuff, but I didn't drink. I mean, yeah, I got stupid, man, because what would I know? You put a chainsaw in my hand, turn me loose out in society, and I know everything, and see what happened. And probably one of my best ones was I had about 3 years, and a friend of mine, brother-in-law, had a house, and he had a couple pine trees, three of them, big ones. They're about 80-foot, 100-foot, and he wanted to take them down, so he got me, because I used to do his work. And so I went over there, and I remember I had the pines, I had them all limbed out, and had them topped, and there was about 80 feet of wood left, and they were about big like this. And I went there one morning, and there was a gap in between the house, and I said, man, I could put that tree right in between the gap. Little boy said, no, piece it down. My little head said, yes, because I wanted to go work, I walk. He said, piece it down. So I didn't listen. So I put the undercut in, put the back cut, and I remember the tree just went like that, and then it just stopped right in midair. And then it just turned right for the house. And then all these house parts are flying all over the neighborhood. And I said, first thing, I'm getting out of here. And the little boy said, no, you can't. So next thing I done is I'm going to blame it on somebody, but that chainsaw was stuck in my hand. But, you know, I rang up the guy's brother, the contractor, and I told him, I'll just pay for it. He said, no, don't worry, it's just wood. Use your insurance. I had insurance, thank goodness. And then, so I rang up the brother, and I told him, he told me right away, he said, oh, man, you're doing a great job out there. I was out there last night. I said, oh, thank you, but. And then I told him, and there's a long silence. But I ran to a meeting, and, you know, I start talking in the meeting, man, and everybody's laughing. They thought that was the funniest thing. And then someone talked about they just hit and run somebody. So mine was just wood, and insurance took care. And show you how AA works, two dudes came up to me after and wanted me to do some tree work. So how I got out of tree work, everybody been telling me quick, because I'm old, man. I'm 78 years old, you know, and I shouldn't be, because I know if I got hurt now, you know, the side of trees, it'd be all over. So God does for me what I can't do. So I was up there doing a big, big pine tree, and the police came. And somebody thought that I was a senile old man just climbing the trees. That's what I do, man. So I don't do trees no more, you know. But on my last walk, I did a walk from Mill Valley to the Buckrow Beach, Virginia. That was 2004. And when I was going over Soledad Pass, I seen a bobcat. I never saw a bobcat ever in my life. And I just had throwaway cameras. And I just was so excited. I mean, it just got my adrenaline. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. And I've taken all these pictures. And when I'd fill the camera, I'd send it home. And I never, you know, I didn't care about walking across the country. I wanted to see my bobcat. So I developed a thing, and I couldn't find my bobcat. I was so just, then I found it. This little dinky thing. And then I got into photography and started getting equipment. Now I got tons of bobcat. And a couple years ago, too, I went in with somebody and we put a book out, but it didn't work out. She wanted to keep all the money, so I'm out of it. But I got a book. So I went from rap sheet to publish, you know. But I have these other friends there, you know, one of them's a retired professor. And she's been on me, and I have a few other friends about putting a book together on my walks, because I have them all audio. And I said, well, you know, I don't know how to write. They said, you could do one, so you just got to start writing. So I've been studying grammar for the past couple of years, learning how to write a sentence, man. But anything, if you want to do anything, you got to do the footwork, you know, and get rid of them expectations. And I don't care if I really get a book, but I like just doing it. It's just like when I'm out there in the woods, and I'm just there being in the moment, because nature is always regenerating my life. And when you get in a world like this, it's a fake world. Nothing happened. I know it, because when I was in San Quentin, I used to always be looking up to the mountain, and I've been up on that mountain so much. So it shows you how my life gets now. I go buy my powders and health food, and then they'll have just this little thing of alcohol. And I remember I went to my sponsor. I told him, is it all right with you? He said, are you obsessing? I said, yeah. Well, don't do it. So I don't, man. Because my sobriety is sacred, believe me. You know. And another thing, I didn't come into these rooms beating people up, jumping on all the women. I kept AA clean, and I like it, because wherever I go, I could talk, and I don't have to look around. And I love that, man, and I love the freedom. I love that freedom. And I have to thank thousands and thousands and thousands of people, you know, because the reason I'm standing here is because of all of you. You know, because I picked a little from each and every. I remember my sponsor, you know, they've tried to get me out of NA, and you know, I said there about 2 years, and he said, go to 1010. That was a, you know, a meeting up there in 21st in Valencia. Alcohol. I said, yeah, okay. So and then he come, did you do it? I said, no. He said, well, go to 5 meeting. I said, yeah, okay. And he come back, did you do it? I said, no. He said, well, go to 1 meeting. So I went up there, and this is when you could smoke, and I opened the door. Billows of smoke came out, and everybody in the meeting looked like DA, judges, and cops. I'm not going to that. But then one day, I was just walking by, and this gal, Eleanor Rose, she was out front. She says, how much time you got? I said, 2 years. She said, you're speaking. I said, man, but I'm not going to argue. I just done it. And then Phil was in there, and he was a secretary of beginners meeting and brought me up Tuesday downtown. Love that meeting every set. But, you know, AA, your life could just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the deal is all I have to do is just not drink no matter what. And I think I ran out of time. But anyway, I want to thank each and every one of you for helping me stay sober today. And I'll do anything to stay sober. I even came to Fresno.